This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Sabrina and Corina, stories by Kali Fajardo Anstein. Read for you by Roxana Ortega, Alma Cuervo, Kyla Garcia, Almarie Guerra, Ana Isabel, and Marisol Ramirez. With your childhood flames on your midnight rug, and your Spanish manners and your mother's drugs, and your cowboy mouth and your curfew plugs, who among them do you think could resist you, sad-eyed lady of the lowlands? Bob Dylan.
Sugar Babies. Read for you by Almarie Guerra. Though the southern Colorado soil was normally hard and cakey, it had snowed and then rained an unusual amount that spring. Some of the boys in my eighth grade class decided it was the perfect ground for playing army. They borrowed shovels and picks from their father's sheds, placing the tools on their bicycle handlebars and riding out to the western edge of our town, Sahuarita, a place where the land with its silken fibers of swaying grass resembled a sleeping woman with her face pressed firmly to the pillow, a golden blonde by day, a raven-haired beauty by night. The first boy to hit bone was Robbie Martinez. He did so with the blunt edge of a rusted shovel. Out of the recently drenched earth, he lifted a piece of brittle, faded whiteness and tossed it downwind like nothing more than a scrap of paper. "Look," he said, kneeling as if he was praying. "Everybody, come look." The other boys gathered around. There in the ground lay broken pieces of bowls with black zigzagging designs. Next to those broken bowls were human teeth, scattered like dried kernels of yellow corn. Above them, the sun had begun to fade behind the tallest peak of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. The sky was pale and bleak, like the bloated belly of a lizard passing above.
"Don't touch it," Robbie said. "None of it. We need to tell somebody."
And tell they did. The entire town, everyone, it seemed, was a witness. Days after their discovery, our final eighth grade project was announced. We gathered in the gym for an assembly. The teachers brought together the boys from technical education class and the girls from home economics. We sat Indian style in 10 rows beneath dangling ropes and resting basketball hoops. The room smelled like a tennis ball dipped in old socks, and the cement walls were padded in purple vinyl, supposedly to minimize dodgeball injuries. I thought it looked like a loony bin. Mrs. Sharpley, a bug-eyed woman with a neck like a giraffe's but a torso like a rhino's, stood before us on a wooden box.
"For the remaining 2 weeks of your junior high career," she said, "you will care for another life."
She then reached behind her into a paper grocery bag, revealing a sack of C&H pure cane sugar.
"Sugar babies. We will be raising our very own sugar babies."
Older kids had gossiped about notorious school projects. We had heard stories of piglet dissections, the infamous growing and changing unit, rocket launches with carbon dioxide canisters, and a cow's lung blackened and doused in cigarette smoke. But no one had warned us about this.
"Sugar babies are a lot of responsibility," Mrs. Sharpley said as she stepped down from her box and paced with the sugar sack.
She explained we were to be graded on skills like feeding, bonding, budgeting, and more. She then passed around diaper directions. We do it all alone?
It was Solana Segura. She was behind me, her perpetual whimper causing every sentence to end like a little howl.
Like single moms and stuff?
Somewhere down the rows, a boy croaked.
But the DNA shows I am not the father.
We chirped with laughter, until Mrs. Sharpley held up two fingers, signaling silence.
Of course not. You'll be in committed partnerships. We're drawing names.
A teacher's aide in Payless Flats scurried like a magician's assistant toward Mrs. Sharpley. She carried two Folgers cans, decorated in pink and blue glitter. Mrs. Sharpley set down her sugar, taking the cans from the aide and giving each a good shake. From the pink can, the first name she pulled was Mimi Yazzie, who stood and slinked forward, burying her face into her arms as Mrs. Sharpley called out her partner, Mike Ramos. This cycle of humiliation lasted for several more rounds before I was partnered with Roberto Martinez, the bone boy. After school, Robbie and I sat outside on the swings. He was a scrawny kid, with frequently chapped lips and a light dusting of freckles across his low nose. He played soccer and always wore a beat-up blue windbreaker and knock-off Adidas sneakers, with four stripes instead of three. The sugar baby was planted snug in his lap, balanced ever so gently between his two stick arms. His dark eyes were so big and wide they resembled two brown pigeon eggs, and he spoke with a quavering, squeaky voice.
They said we have to name it. Do you want to pick it out, Sierra?
No. You name it. I swung up. And you take it home tonight. I swung down. I'll watch it tomorrow, but only if I have to.
That's cool, he said. What about Miranda? That's my grandma's name.
Whatever. I sighed, leaning back on the swing. Name it after your grandmother. Name it after your entire family. I don't care. I pumped until the rusted chain pulled taut. Then I jumped, landing in the mushy gravel with both feet. I took off for home.
Ain't that something?
My father said as he and I ate breakfast the next morning. On our small black and white TV above the microwave, aerial shots of the dig site were being shown on the news. The land appeared as an enormous shadow box with scraps of ancient people instead of thimbles and porcelain knickknacks.
Can we go see it?
I asked, spooning my last bit of cornflakes into my mouth.
I suspect they don't want us to do that,
he said, keeping his eyes to the TV. There were deep lines around his eyelids. His hair was purely silver, and his hands were spotted from years of working as a roofer beneath the Colorado sun. People had begun to mistake him for my grandfather.
Why not? We should be allowed to.
I walked to the sink and tossed my dirty dish inside.
It's where we're from. It's our people.
My father scratched his chin. There was a thin turquoise ring on his finger, where there had once been a gold wedding band.
Don't leave a dish in the sink, he said. How many times I got to tell you that, Sierra?
I turned back and soaped up my bowl. I mean it, I want to go.
Things like this have always happened around here. It's nothing special.
I told him it was new to me, as I scrubbed my dish with a green and yellow sponge, the milky water gargling loudly down the drain's black rubber lips. As I rinsed the bowl once more, I peered through the window above the sink. The morning was clear, and in the distance, the mountains were crystal blue, like an enormous wave.
as if sailing across those waters, a small white pickup truck with a front-end bra pulled down our street and rumbled over the gravel in our driveway. Long, dark hair clouded the truck's windshield, and very red and very long fingernails were coiled around the steering wheel. A silver rosary dangled above the dash. "Papa!" I called over my shoulder, drying my hands on my jeans. My father rose and stood tall behind me, smelling of leather and dirt.
"Looks like she's back again."
He grunted some, swishing spit around inside his mouth before shooting a stream of yolky bile into the sink.
"Go outside, Sierra. Say hello to your mother."
My mother first left 3 years earlier. It happened one morning after she cooked breakfast. I watched as she gathered her keys and coat and walked into our wintry yard without any shoes. She left footprints as slight as bird tracks in the snow. When I asked my father later why she had left, he simply said,
"Sometimes a person's unhappiness can make them forget they are part of something bigger. Something like a family, a people, even a tribe."
My mother occasionally would come home for a day or two to gather forgotten necklaces or purses, though over time, my father moved her things from the bedroom to a box in the crawl space. Her visits were infrequent enough that I learned to live without her. It wasn't easy at first. Sometimes I'd hear a funny story at school or church, and my first thought would be, "You have to tell Mama." But over time, that urge to be with her, to tell her things, to be a part of her, it went away, just like she always did. On my mother's first night back, she couldn't find an apron, so she made dinner in one of my father's old t-shirts. With the kitchen TV up loud on Entertainment Tonight, she cooked pork chops sizzled in their own fat and smothered in green chili. Whenever I'd glance up from my math homework on the coffee table, I'd catch glimpses of her in the kitchen, rummaging through junk drawers and cabinets. I wondered what she was searching for, and thought to offer my help, but I realized I didn't care if my mother found anything in our home again. When she finally called my father and me to the big table, I pulled my sugar sack, Miranda Martinez Cordova, from my backpack. "Dinner time," I whispered, admiring the face I had given her with a Sharpie. Her eyes were big and wide with short lines for lashes. Her mouth was a blissfully flat smirk. "Your favorite," my mother said, handing a plate to my father. He casually spun it above his head and eased into his seat at the table. The two of them were acting as if nothing had happened, as if my mother had always been there cooking in the kitchen. I felt like my father was a liar, someone who could pretend everything was fine when, really, how could he be anything but sad?
"Do you want something to drink, Sierra?"
asked my mother. "No," I said, covering Miranda's mouth. "I don't want anything."
"Nonsense," said my mother. "You're becoming a woman. Women need vitamins and nutrients. You'll have some milk."
My mother opened a cupboard, the small one beside the stove where the glasses had once been, but my father corrected her with a flick of his knife.
"Left of the sink."
My mother tilted her head and steadied her mouth into a tight smile. After pouring the milk, she placed the glass in front of me and quickly glanced at Miranda. Robbie had dressed her in one of his little sister's old striped pink onesies.
"Does your doll want a plate?"
"She's not a doll, and she's way too young for solids." My mother laughed and took her seat, closing her eyes while my father led us in prayer. Miranda and I kept our eyes open. My mother had taken off the old t-shirt and wore a blue dress with white embroidered flowers that had many loose threads. Her lips were thinner, and her black hair was shorter than I remembered. She used to only wear silver, but she had on a gold necklace, the thin braided chain glowing against her bronze skin. After we said amen, my parents made the sign of the cross, and my mother opened her reddish-brown eyes. Her eye makeup appeared as a buildup of silt. "You know," she said, turning to me, "I thought we were out of salt. I was going to have you run next door to ask Mrs. Kelly if we could borrow some." "She's dead." I hunched down and rested my chin on Miranda's head. "What?" "She's not alive anymore." My father gently said, "Old Mrs. Kelly passed away last winter, Josie." My mother mouthed an, "Oh," and looked at her plate. She briskly apologized, and we continued dinner in silence. Above us, the ceiling fans spun in rapid circles, slicing the air, sending waves of coolness over each of us. My mother and father kept glancing at one another, smiling, chewing, smiling, sipping, and smiling some more. After some time, I got sick of their cheeriness and gulped the last of my milk. Then, as loud as possible, I slammed my empty glass on the table. "So, Josie," I said, "what brings you down from Denver? Or do you normally drive around cooking pork chops for people?"
"Sierra," my father barked, "don't you call your mother by her first name."
He shook his head, and I avoided his strict gaze. My mother smiled sweetly.
"Tell me about all those Indian graves the boys from your school found out west."
My stomach suddenly lurched with the sounds of digestive failure.
"I don't know anything about it," I said, stroking Miranda.
"Sure you do," my father interjected. "That Roberto Martinez, the boy who found the bones, he's your partner for that sugar thing, your school project."
"To think," my mother said, "this whole time those bones were right in Sahuarita, beneath our feet."
"That's not true," I said. "They weren't beneath your feet." She giggled a bit.
"I was here for a long while, Sierra. I think I know a thing or two about Sahuarita."
Though I wanted to tell her she didn't know about anything, I turned my face to my lap and went quiet. After dinner, I sat in my room, where I pressed my ear against the cool white door. Muffled and low, I could hear my father in the living room ask my mother about her drive. Road conditions, springtime flurries, if the mountain goats hobbled along the pass. He didn't ask why she was back, or if she missed us. Questions that hurt me to think about. I moved away from the door and tossed Miranda into the corner.
"She cried all night. I didn't get any sleep," I told Robbie the next morning as I shoved Miranda into his arms.
We met outside 30 minutes before school in our usual spot by the swings. It was chilly, and the air smelled like pancake breakfast and frost.
"How could she cry?" he asked. "She's only sugar."
The sun was coming up. The light leaked over the land in velvety streaks of pinks and golds. My mother once told me this meant the angels were baking cookies.
"Isn't that what babies do? Cry and crap themselves and cry some more?"
"Hey," Robbie said,
his chapped mouth bunched to the side.
"Where's her outfit?"
"Lost it."
Robbie sighed and bent down to his backpack. He pulled a diaper from the front mesh pocket.
Give her here. We'll lose points if she's wearing the same diaper from last night.
He lay Miranda on the loose gravel and frowned at the new, sad, sleepy face I had given her that morning. Her eyelashes were tarantula-like, and her mouth was downturned. Robbie fumbled with the diaper, applying and reapplying the adhesive sides.
So, I said, standing above him, what was it like? What was what like, Sierra?
Finding those dead people. Was it scary? Robbie got the diaper to stick. He patted Miranda's black marker face and stood up with a bounce.
Not scary, he said. But it was weird, you know. We've lived here our whole lives and no one knew about all this old stuff in the ground.
I guess, I said, thinking of the piñon trees where my father had hung a bluish hammock in our yard. Their roots, he said, had undoubtedly grazed the dead bodies of our ancestors, both Spanish and Indian. I used to play in the shade of those piñons, cracking their nuts with two rocks held firmly in my hands. After pulling away the hard shells, I'd toss the spongy insides into my mouth. I didn't swallow them, though. I was afraid of letting any amount of death, from the soil or elsewhere, work its way into me.
Everything is old here. I mean, everything.
Robbie nodded. He was rocking Miranda back and forth in such a way I'd only seen small girls do with dolls.
I heard your mom's back again. My grandma saw her buying pork chops at Rainbow Market.
I kicked at the gravel, scuffing my Mary Janes. Dust flew between us.
The bitch is back.
Robbie pretended to cover Miranda's ears.
Dude, he said, don't call your mom a bitch. What if Miranda called you a bitch?
Guess it's a good thing babies can't talk, I said, especially ones made of sugar. Robbie was smiling and had lifted Miranda into the air. He briefly held her against the sky before bringing her back down.
Remember when your mom was our group leader for Day on the Prairie?
Yeah, I said, lowering my voice.
And we all got lost looking for that old barn she said was haunted. Then she let us eat 3 packs of Oreos, and you had to go to the bathroom in the bushes.
Robbie laughed, but I frowned, and he quickly turned serious.
Why is she back this time?
The school bell sounded. Class was starting in 10 minutes. We reached for our backpacks and walked toward the front doors. I lifted Miranda from Robbie's arms.
Who knows with that woman? Maybe she wants to see the dig site.
Or maybe she likes taking vacations to her old life. Within a week, my mother blended into our home as well as Miranda did. Which is to say, not very well at all. When it was just my father, he worked late and usually only had time to heat up a frozen pizza or fix a box of macaroni. Our small purple house was often messy, though we each had a chore list that was conquered by Sunday. With my mother back, the home took on a new order, a different rhythm. She cooked unhealthy but comforting foods, the house constantly emitting a pungent odor of bacon grease and red chili powder. Other times, she cleaned. She'd twirl around with a broom, swaying her hips to the music on the radio, an oldies station or some honky-tonk crap. Most evenings, after my father came home from work, he'd unlace his boots in the foyer and then move his arm along my mother's slight waist. Together, they'd rock back and forth to the music. It was nauseating. Each day after school, I'd come home to discover that my mother had made my bed and placed my stuffed animals in a dog pile above my pillows. I'd immediately throw them to the floor. With a detergent that reeked of artificial springtime and cottony clouds, she also did my laundry, taking the time to match my socks, a luxury I hadn't experienced in years. One afternoon, as I sat on the couch, my feet covered in those matching socks and kicked up on the armrest, my mother walked by and swiped them down like she was swatting a fly.
"What are you doing inside? It's a beautiful day."
Her arms were planted firmly at her sides. She wore a brightly colored tunic and black leggings, making her appear like a 1960s glamour model. She was young still, only in her mid-30s.
"It's hotter than a pig's armpit out there."
I craned my neck, looking past her at the television. An Herbal Essence shampoo commercial was on, and long-haired women were moaning under waterfalls.
"You have such a foul mouth," my mother said. "And pigs don't have armpits, genius."
She began lifting sofa pillows as though searching for something.
"Hey, where's that sugar bag you carry around? Your little baby for school?"
"She's with her father. He has her until the weekend."
"Oh,"
my mother said.
"Well, get up off this sofa. We're going for a drive."
I couldn't remember the last time I had been alone with my mother in a car.
"What? Where to?"
She smiled, the seams of her mouth running with red lipstick.
"You'll see."
We parked on a steep hill overlooking the dig site. Below us, archaeologists in white hats and khaki shorts swarmed the gutted earth like invasive ants. The plot was as long and wide as a shallow public swimming pool and was divvied up into human-sized squares. The sky was cloudless and blue, except for the sun's golden orb. At the horizon, there was a crashing display of earth and air. My mother stood before me and held her arms out, flapping them as if they were useless wings. Wind blew her hair, twirling the strands around her face, hiding her eyes behind sections of black. For the first time since she'd come home, I remembered how beautiful I once found her to be. As a little girl, I'd play dress-up in her satin nightdresses and lacy bras, admiring their slight weight and wondering if I'd ever own clothes like that.
"What do you think?" she asked. "Isn't it pretty?"
I shrugged and stood beside her. The wind carried her jasmine scent.
"Ever feel like the land is swallowing you whole, Sierra? That all of this beauty is wrapped around you so tight it's like being in a rattlesnake's mouth?"
"I see this all the time," I said, "and I don't feel like I'm being eaten alive by anything." My mother gave me a sideways glance.
"You will someday. Maybe it'll come later for you than it did for me. Children tend to do that. Marriage, life, all these things."
Moving behind me, she hunched down and slipped her cold hands over my eyes.
"Try it. Close your eyes and hold your arms against the wind. You'll feel it."
I allowed my arms to float up and coast. A kaleidoscope of images spun against my closed lids. I saw the day when I was 10 years old, right before my mother left for the first time. She took me to the pueblo where her grandmother was born in New Mexico. Holding my hand, my mother walked us through a small adobe church. She touched the pews with the tips of her red nails as we moved closer to the altar. We stepped into a side room where we lit white candles with long, slim sticks. My mother sent prayers for all those she loved into the sky with smoke. But I sent only one.
"Please," I pleaded to the Virgin, "don't let my mother cry anymore."
I was sick of finding her silently weeping, the sobs bobbing in her throat, at the stove, in the bathtub, kneeling in the dead garden beside our house. When I opened my eyes, my mother was beside me, a strange blank expression on her face.
"Did you feel it?"
she asked.
"No," I said. "I didn't feel anything."
Goose pimples rose on my neck and arms.
"It's just windy and cold."
"All right, Sierra. Then let's get home. I'll start dinner." As she headed for her pickup, I looked over the hill's edge and down into the dig site once more. The archaeologists were huddled in small groups. The rich odor of disrupted earth blew into me. Everything was terrifyingly silent. I thought about how quiet the world could sound, and how when I stood there beside my mother, for a moment, I was afraid she had left me on the hillside, stranded forever.
"Xerophthalmia," Mrs. Sharpley said, "is one of many childhood diseases your babies could get."
It was the following Monday, the final week of sugar babies. Another assembly was being held in the gym. Two kids in front of me had swaddled their baby in a blanket, while others around us had glued on googly eyes and red yarn mouths. Robbie sat beside me with Miranda. She looked exceptionally fashionable. That morning, I had wrapped a quilted pillowcase around her like a muumuu dress.
"Among other things," Mrs. Sharpley continued, "xerophthalmia is a vitamin A deficiency which makes it so a person can't produce tears."
I leaned over to Robbie. "I wish you had that disease. Then you'd stop whining about me drawing a Miranda." I had recently drawn crucifixes and anchors across her back. Tattoos, I called them. But Robbie said she looked like a bathroom wall.
"She's a baby," he whispered with closed eyes. "Babies don't need tattoos."
"Sugar," I said. "She is a bag of sugar." "Now think for a moment," Mrs. Sharpley said, waving both arms into the air. "Think of all the times you cry. Sometimes they are happy and sometimes they are sad. But crying is natural. Take a moment to remember the last time you cried."
The gymnasium went silent. Only the hiss of the fluorescent lights above us could be heard. Students hung their heads, as if possessed by their darkest, most sorrowful memories. I waited for the other students to finish reminiscing about their dear old dead grandparents and broken bones.
"Now, parents," said Mrs. Sharpley, "you can see that not being able to cry would be an awful condition. For homework, we will each need to research a childhood disease. Tomorrow we will draw diseases from a hat. Some babies will get a disease, but just like in life, some will not. It's the luck of the draw."
Later that day, Robbie hurried after me as I walked home. His backpack seemed comically wider than he did.
"You have to take Miranda," he said. "I have soccer tonight."
From the giant backpack, he scooped Miranda out, slowly handing her over. She was somehow heavier than usual.
"What the heck have you been feeding her?" I asked.
Robbie petted her belly.
"That was weird, Mrs. Sharpley asking about crying."
She's a real wacko, I said, hoisting Miranda on my hip.
The sky was endlessly blue, with paper wisps of clouds. I caught myself tilting Miranda up to see.
So, when was it, Robbie? The last time you cried?
That's sort of personal, Sierra.
Roberto Martinez, I'm your child's mother. I deserve to know these things.
All right.
Robbie took a deep breath.
After I found the bones, that night I woke up and thought I saw a skeleton woman at the foot of my bed. I didn't know who she was, but later my grandma told me it was Dona Sebastiana, the lady version of the Grim Reaper. Death.
You cried from a bad dream?
No, Sierra. It was more than that.
Robbie scratched his head, and his scalp sounded sandy.
What about you? When's the last time you cried?
I peered down the block at my little purple house. My mother's pickup wasn't in the driveway, and I figured she had gone to Rainbow Market for more pork chops. But for a moment, something in my chest ached. A gnawing worry that she was gone again. This time for good. I broke into a sprint and ran toward home.
I don't cry, I called over my shoulder. Only little girls and babies do that.
I have some new tattoo ideas, I said to Miranda, who sat on the kitchen table, stiffly leaning to the left in a column of sunlight.
I was sifting through the junk drawer looking for markers. I had opened every window, and for the first time in days, the house didn't smell like pork. It reeked with the richness of the mountains and desert, rain and sage and cedar pulled together as one. When I realized the drawer only had rubber bands and dead batteries, I said,
"Don't worry, you little sack of cavities. I have some markers in my room."
I crawled beneath my bed, over the uncrushed carpet, surrounded by gobs of lint and bald hair. I was looking for a shoebox filled with art supplies, but I ended up fishing out my private property box instead. The place where I kept movie ticket stubs, old diaries, and birthday cards from my mother. She made the cards herself, and I imagined her in some sunny apartment in downtown Denver. Houseplants and cacti lined the windows, while filtered city light fell upon her at the sofa, licking stamps and writing out her old address. Sitting on my floor, my legs spread and the birthday cards dumped around me like confetti, I ran my fingers over their sharp edges and smooth ribbons. I came upon one from my 11th birthday, the first card my mother sent after she left. I held the purple and gold paper in my palm, then opened the card as if it were the warm, beating heart of an animal. My mother had placed 3 marigolds inside, and they nearly crumbled in my hands. To my baby, Sierra, today is your birthday. And when you were born, I knew everything would change. That every day would be your day. That nothing would be the same. I climbed onto my bed, where I nestled into Miranda.
See this?
I said. This is from my mom. I looked at her sad face, and for a split second, I imagined Miranda as a real infant, a baby who breathed and cried. I rolled her to my lips and dryly kissed her forehead.
I don't know if I'm very nice to you,
I whispered. I then caught a glimpse of my mother standing in the doorway. She was leaning into the wall, limp and fragile. Her reddish-brown eyes were without makeup, and her hair was stacked in a sloppy pile on top of her head.
You're good with her?
She isn't real, I said.
My mother stepped toward me, moving gracefully in her skin. She sat on the foot of my bed with very straight posture and stiff arms. She seemed nervous, the way cats stiffen their backs before danger strikes.
It's sort of strange they make you kids do this. You're only 13, but I can understand how they think it prepares you, I suppose. Not that having a sack of sugar for 2 weeks would prepare anyone for a new life.
I pulled Miranda closer and wiggled my thumb over her quilted midsection.
I'm not sure if anyone is prepared for raising a child. It doesn't seem to be something we can practice before it actually happens.
I shrugged and rolled Miranda onto my belly.
Where did you go today?
My mother stared straight ahead, her eyes glassy.
For a drive through the canyon. Would you believe it? I saw two hawks. They were playing in the wind.
Hawks were common in Sahuarita. We had an entire unit in sixth grade about them. They danced before mating, could dive 150 miles per hour, stayed with one partner all their lives. I was surprised that my mother paid them any attention.
What kinds of birds do you see in the city? I asked.
Crows, said my mother. Just a bunch of crows. She paused, tracing Miranda's eyelashes with her long red nails.
How long do you have her?
A few more days, I said, rubbing Miranda's back slowly.
I can't wait to get rid of this thing. She's so annoying.
Imagine someday when it's a real baby. It will be much harder.
That's the point, I said. Miranda isn't real. If she was, I'd be a lot nicer to her, like Robbie is. He's better at taking care of her.
My mother folded her hands neatly in her lap. She kneaded her fingers back and forth, and a trickle of sadness moved between us, like a static shock.
Can you believe that when you were born, I was only 3 years older than you are now?
She forced a laugh, dropped her gaze to the carpet.
I had to stop going to school.
Did you miss it? I asked. My mother sighed and considered my question for a long time.
I didn't know I could miss school. I thought I was just sad.
But I take classes now at a community college. You could go there someday. My mother went quiet. She pulled the rubber band from her head, allowing her hair to unravel around her shoulders and neck. She looked gloriously dark and light at the same time. There was a shining glint in her brown eyes. She looked younger. She looked happy.
I bet you'll be an artist someday, Sierra.
My mother pointed to the tattoos across Miranda's back.
That's what I want it to be.
She smiled, and we both laughed.
Here, she said, let me braid your hair. I can do a tight one that will last for a few days.
I pulled away at first, but soon moved back toward my mother. I was ashamed of myself that I still wanted her close to me, even after everything she had done. I eventually rested my head in her chilly hands and tried to forget how bad my mother had hurt me. Her fingers wove through my hair like she was sewing a quilt. I nearly fell asleep in her arms as I held Miranda in my own. Lying there with my mother in the afternoon light of my bedroom, I imagined her far into the future, driving day and night, her little white truck sliding from mountain peak to valley, through snow and heat waves, windstorms and lightning. her headlights beam bright and warm, shining into town. The place where I'll live when I'm finally a grown-up, and my mother's black hair is silver, and her face is well-lined. In the distance, I see her arriving, joyously waving to me, her last stop. When I woke up the next morning, my father was alone at the kitchen table eating oatmeal and reading the newspaper. Part of me wanted to ask where my mother was, but I knew she was already heading north over the pass, back to that sunny apartment of hers in Denver. Even her chair was gone from the table. My father scooted a bowl of cereal toward me. He then smacked the paper with his hand.
"I'll be damned," he said. "Those Indians on the ridge, they got some formal petition going. They're closing up the dig site."
His eyes met mine over the top of the paper.
"Sorry I didn't take you to see it, Sierra. There will be another one someday."
"I did see it," I said. "Mama took me." My father swallowed hard and shook out the paper. It sounded like rain.
"Want some orange juice with your breakfast? I got the kind without pulp that you like."
"No, Papa," I said. "I'm not feeling too good. Would it be okay if I stayed home from school?" He raised his white eyebrows. They reflected the low sunlight pouring into the kitchen through the sheer curtains above the sink.
"If you feel that bad, then of course you can."
I spent most of the day in bed with Miranda cupped in my arms. We listened to the radio perched on my windowsill. The country songs my mother liked filled the small bedroom, and every now and then, I'd lean over with Miranda close to my chest and feel like crying. Then, at 3 o'clock, there was a quick knock on the door. Robbie stood on my stoop, covered in a mist of sweat around his temples and beneath his mouth.
"What are you doing here?"
I asked.
"And why are you out of breath? Did you skip or something?"
He wagged his head back and forth.
"It's awful, Sierra. Just awful."
"I'm sure you're a wonderful skipper. Don't be so hard on yourself."
"No, not that. It's Miranda."
He hunched over and took a huge breath.
"She's dead."
"Miranda can't die, moron."
Robbie peered at me, a deep sadness in his gaze.
"We pulled diseases out of a hat today. Most kids didn't get anything bad. Some got chicken pox. But Miranda, she got SIDS. If you don't know what that is because you didn't do your homework, it means sudden infant death syndrome."
"I know what SIDS is," I said. "What are we supposed to do now? Throw her away?"
"But we can't," Robbie whined. "It's Miranda."
I stared at him for a long while, counting how many times he blinked without tears rolling out of his eyes. Then I said, "I have an idea." Robbie and I parked our bikes near the edge of the hill overlooking the dig site. I had wrapped Miranda in a black pillowcase. She resembled a baby nun. I pulled her from my handlebar basket and one last time arched her face to the heavens. There was a mass of gray clouds. They spread evenly over the land like a patchwork of fog.
"Look,"
I whispered.
"Even the sky is sad for you."
Robbie stood beside me at the border between the hill and the dig site. He reached out with a thin chicken wing of an arm and patted Miranda softly on the head. We stood at the edge of the hill for some time, listening to the grumbling moans of the clouds and the far-off crackling of thunder.
I picked out a spot easy to aim for in the middle of the pit. Then, tipping back, I readied myself to launch Miranda above my head with both arms, but Robbie stopped me.
You're going to throw Miranda in there?
What else can we do? With those big, sad eyes, he looked into the dig site. Then he looked at me.
I can kick her farther.
You're going to kick our baby into her grave? The wind carried my voice away from me, as if it wasn't my own to begin with.
I play soccer, Sierra.
Taking her from my arms, he delicately set Miranda on the edge of the hill, her limp body leaning mostly to the left. He backed up a few steps, and then pushed himself forward with huge strides, his arms flying. When his tennis shoe made contact with Miranda, her body lifted from the earth as though she was nothing more than a helium balloon. She twirled in the air as her sugar insides spiraled out of her body from a hole Robbie's foot had torn in the bag. The sugar blew with the wind, sprinkling the dirt with bits of white. How pretty, I thought, and she landed with a thud.
Sabrina and Karina. Read for you by Roxana Ortega. My grandmother called with the news. Though I wasn't entirely surprised, I had to ask her 4 times to repeat herself. Strangled, she said over the phone. That's how it happened. I was doing makeup at Macy's at the time, and after finishing my last face of the day, I drove to her house, where my youngest cousins played tag in the yard. I made my way past them through the chain-link gate, holding my purse above my head as they yelled my name and swirled around me, trying to get me to join their game. Inside, in the front room, my father was splayed out on the couch with a Rockies cap pulled over his eyes. One of my uncles leaned beside him, lightly clutching the remote. Another sat motionless on an old recliner, his eyes to his glowing cell phone. From the back bedroom came the howling cries of Sabrina's mother. The men flinched but carried on watching the muted television screen. No one acknowledged my arrival. In the kitchen, my grandmother stirred 3 restaurant-sized steel pots with a wooden spoon. Her nails were golden and long, and her silver hair was up, bouffant style. I had experienced enough Cordova deaths to know one pot was filled with green chili, another with pintos, and the last one with menudo. Deaths, weddings, birthdays, the menu was always the same. Here, my grandmother said, pointing with the spoon to a mound of raw pork on the table. Make yourself useful. I took my place among the women. My mother and I silently chopped the pork into small pieces for the chili. One of my aunties made a pitcher of lemonade, another chopped onions, and another readied plates of food for the men. We worked quickly and silently, shouldering past one another in the small kitchen. A few cousins sat Indian style on the linoleum floor, sorting through a Payless shoebox of family photos. They passed around photos of Sabrina as though they had suddenly forgotten how she looked. Such thick, long, black hair, they said. Look at her blue eyes in this one. They had always admired Sabrina, copying her makeup and her clothes. She was the family beauty, the gorgeous cousin, their lovely doll. It was only a matter of time, I thought, before they emulated her in other ways. One of them had already been suspended for showing up to math class drunk from the night before. She had been with a boy. Her knees were bleeding. My youngest cousin gazed at a photo of Sabrina bikini-clad along the creek in Boulder. What a pretty figure, she said, pinching her own stomach and sulking. I carried the cutting board to the stove and pushed the pork into a skillet. My grandma